It is apparent to many that there is something terribly wrong with the way our species has chosen for some time to interact with our planet. And we all, at some point in our lives, may feel disconnected from the world around us. Though we do, in fact, grow like a bud on a branch or vine in this world, we seem to feel instead like strangers in a strange land, cast adrift into a chaotic system up against the forces of nature and doomed in the end to oblivion. But is this the ultimate state of reality? Is this vision a true and accurate portrait? Or is there another version of reality we might embrace and empower ourselves through? What our guest tonight calls a transcendence or transcendence of the single self identity experienced in the mysteries. This transcendence, he describes, has two senses, with and without the hyphen. Trans-entience is going beyond entity or single self identity, and transcendence, with no hyphen, is deep sentient immersion in all that lives, as in sensing through all life. So here we are in our world today, surrounded on all sides by what one might perceive or many might perceive as dark, twisted, and nefarious forces bent on our enslavement and ultimate destruction. I was talking to Bob Tuscan today, going over some future projects. Bob Tuscan has his own show called The Bob Tuscan Show on Oracle Broadcasting, and we hope to work on some future projects together. An appearance on The Bob Tuscan Show for Radio Free Humanity is in the works at a not-so-distant future date. Well, Bob was remarking on the blessings of having a large family, as my wife and I do. By the way, Mater X is in the middle chamber chat line for Radio Free Humanity as we speak, thanks to her, as always. And anyway, having said that, Bob remarked how hard it was for him to imagine bringing children into a world so filled with evil and darkness and suffering. And yet we know we cannot let the darkness stop the light. We know we must bring new life, hope, and promise into this world, issues of overpopulation notwithstanding. We must not fear doom and despair. And when faced with all that seems to surround in the way of dangers and destructions, whether personally or collectively, we are perennially offered ways of liberation and self-actualization in various forms as means of overcoming inevitables. But from where do we launch our will? Where to muster the commitment and simple bravery to meet the challenges posed to each one of us? And from what premise might we commence such actions? Well, tonight we will explore just such a premise. And the premise none other than a supreme reality that our very world is the embodiment of the goddess of wisdom, Gaia Sophia, and that we are integral co-creators in this process of unfoldment of the dream of Sophia, which we know as the world of reality surrounding us. Author, mythologist, and mystic visionary John Lamlash will present his revealed system of dynamic interface with Gaia, which he calls Planetary Tantra. Visit his website, metahistory.org, and read all his materials and lectures and teachings. Take a virtual tour of the site with John himself as the guide and narrator. Now, what we set out to do tonight, Mr. Lash himself has said in his own work titled Introducing Planetary Tantra, which can be found on metahistory.org. This is the quote. It is next to impossible to transmit planetary tantra by exposition and discourse. Transmission happens through direct contact, via the spark of delight leaping from one guy in Tantrika to another. So, you know, having said that, let's commence from that point and launch this nearly impossible discourse, so to speak, and welcome author John Lamlash. Good evening, John. Or should I say good morning?
Yeah, good morning. Good evening. It's good to be with you.
That's great to have you. How are you?
Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. I love your introduction, and you said some great things there that really set the tone not only for planetary tantra in a beautiful way, but just for living on this planet in the same manner. I couldn't agree with you more, you know. Dream every day of the way we can coexist together. Love and freedom go together. There is no love without freedom, no freedom without love. And the power of that combination dispels fear. So I'm 100% with you on that that approach. Fear is the enemy. Fear is what has to be overcome. And there has been for some time a kind of blanket or fog of fear spread around this world. And I feel the day when that fog is dissipating. As we speak, I feel the moment, and that is a wonderful moment to be alive.
Awesome. Well, listen, I have a little quote here that came from. Are you familiar with Laura Eisenhower?
Yeah, a bit. Yeah.
She spoke at the Free Your Mind conference a couple months ago in Philadelphia, and it there's a video of it. But she made this comment that sounded so much like what we hear from you. I wanted to read it to you. It's really quick, just a little comment. She said, "When Sophia realized her Gaian form, she was separated from the Pleroma. In that moment, she felt disconnected from the source and alone. Negative feelings arose, fear, loneliness, panic, uncertainty, anger, confusion. In that moment, the Archons were born." That was her take on the Gaian mythos. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, I restored this Gnostic myth that is found in fragmentary form in the so-called Nag Hammadi writings, which are some Coptic texts discovered in Egypt in 1945. And from the material in those texts and also some additional materials relating to them, I restored this sacred myth, what I consider to be the sacred myth of the mysteries, which is a story told in poetic and metaphorical form, as it were, of an event that actually happened in our galaxy. And that is the event of the fall of the goddess Sophia, who was a powerful goddess at the center of the galaxy, and how the Earth was created, and how the Archons arose. And since I'm the only Gnostic scholar who ever, you know, restored that story in its entirety, and I'd like to point out that since my book came out in 2006, it's about 5 years now, word's getting around, you know, about this story. People are talking about it, and they're using the word Sophia. Sometimes they're using my hyphenated term that I introduced, Gaia Sophia. And people are using the name of Sophia, but it doesn't always mean that they are speaking from that story. I'm happy to hear that people excuse me, are using her name and referring to her as the sacred presence of the Earth. Of course, I'm pleased about that. But I need to point out that as the shaman and scholar who restored that story and brought it back to the world out of oblivion, it's a story that needs to be observed carefully and told in its integrity and maintained. And so the fact that someone is using the name Sophia does not necessarily mean that they're observing that story. As a matter of fact, what Laura Eisenhower says is fine, but it's not correct in terms of the story. The Archons did not come and appear out of any kind of fear or emotion that Sophia had when she morphed into the Earth. They appeared long before the Earth ever appeared. And that's an important part of the story.
Okay, that's excellent. Thank you for that clarity. That's excellent.
And just on behalf of both of us, John, we'd like to say thank you for all of your work restoring the story. Thank you for writing Not in His Image. We both find it to be extremely valuable. And thanks for doing that. We want to recognize you for restoring that myth. On the subject of myth, could you talk to us a little bit about the importance of, you know, telling and retelling stories and mythology and sharing them with each other and with the next generation?
Certainly, there's two points that I'd like to make about myth. First is that I stand at this sort of pinnacle of a very great heritage of mythology, and I am the recipient and heir through my life of and through the studies that I've undertaken of a great sequence of work in this field. You can say, in one respect, perhaps you could go back to, say, 1800, and you could say that comparative mythology, as such, was born with Sir William Jones, who was an English scholar who was in India and who began to investigate some of the Vedic and Vedic materials and Vedic myths of that time. And he was actually the scholar, Sir William Jones, who introduced the word Tantra into the West. He was the first one who discovered certain so-called Tantric documents and teachings, which were kind of sinister and mysterious at that time. No one really quite understood them, you know. They seemed to be connected with black magic somehow. They seemed to be connected with sexuality. And they had a reputation for being so the so-called left-handed path. You know, there was something taboo about them. Anyway, Jones introduced the word Tantra. He brought the initial knowledge of Tantric writings to the West. And he also compared Greek and Sanskrit words and Greek and Sanskrit deities.
John, you were just talking to us about Sir William Jones and laying a groundwork for mythology. Could you please pick it back up where you left off, sir?
Sure. To continue with the two points I wanted to make, the first point is that if we go back to around 1800 and come forward, we have a little over 200 years of extraordinary research which produced the field of comparative mythology. And comparative mythology is the comparison and summation and overview of all the myths of the entire world. It's not just specializing in Greek mythology or Scandinavian or Japanese, but it's an overview that compares the themes and the patterns found in all these myths. So it's a tremendous field. It's developed in the 19th century, starting with Tyler, who introduced the idea of animism, then Sir James Frazer, who wrote The Golden Bough. And then, of course, when we come into the 20th century, we have Mircea Eliade, the great Romanian mythologist, and Joseph Campbell, who died in 1986. And so on the foundation of this 200 years of work, the world inherited this vast body of material. And I was fortunate enough to spend a good part of my life absorbing this, not in an academic framework, because I'm not an academic scholar. I'm a freelance scholar. I don't have any letters behind my name. But in absorbing this and being the heir in some respects to this great development, I was able to be positioned to take it to the next step. And that's really the exciting part, because with directive mythology, as I call it, and with planetary tantra, we're talking about, and with the recovery of the Sophia myth, which is a great key to the whole process, we're talking about a completely new way of looking at mythology. Joseph Campbell himself pointed to this in his book Creative Mythology, which is one of the volumes of The Masks of God. He proposed what he called the next phase of mythology, and he outlined what it would be, and he gave certain principles for creative mythology. I can't quote them right now, but I'll tell you that one of them that's outstanding is that the creative mythology of the future, as he saw it, would allow each individual to activate their own divine creative potential, and it would give a framework for us as a species to find our true direction, as it were. So Joseph Campbell was, in a sense, prophetic in pointing to that, but he himself did not achieve it. He himself was still a scholar who was merely accumulating this massive field of rich comparative material. And we are positioned in the most fantastic way. Our generation, my generation, starting in 1945, and then the following generation now, and the generation to come, it's as if all the momentum that was developed over those 200 years comes to us, and it is available now to experiment and explore in this kind of mythology, which I call directive or applied mythology. This is no longer mythology where you're sitting back just talking about a myth and using it to interpret your experience or interpret your dreams. This is actually working in the deep core and the deep dynamic of the human imagination, which is the greatest power we have for creativity, and using it in all kinds of ways. So that is one of the things I wanted to say about myth. The other thing is that because I drew upon the heritage of these scholars, and they were mostly men, but they were also women, such as Ellen Jane Harrison, a great Greek scholar, and Maria Gimbutas, who revived the studies of the goddess cultures, Merlin Stone, another revivalist, Rhianne Eisler, of course. Women played a very important role in bringing us to the point we are now. And because I was able to look at all the myths in the world, and studies say the creation myths of the Aborigines, of the various tribes of the American Indians, of the Maya or the Aztec, compare them to the Greek creation myth or the Scandinavian or Teutonic mythology, I was able to discern that the myth of the divine Sophia, which comes to us out of the pagan mysteries, was absolutely unique in all this material. And I couldn't have reached to that conclusion and that observation if, of course, I hadn't looked at all the other material. But I can guarantee you that is the case. And it is unique in a number of counts. But what is particularly important right now to understand is that it is unique in that it was an open-ended myth. It is an open-ended myth. The last chapter of this myth was not written. It was left open. And there was a theme that the Gnostics discussed among themselves, which they bequeathed to us, the theme of so-called Sophia's correction. And this represents a cosmic event that would happen in our world, intimately connected to the life of the wisdom goddess, who is Sophia, who is the earth embodied. And so this fantastically beautiful and complex myth doesn't end with a doomsday scenario. This myth leads to an experience of immense beauty and liberation for the human species. It doesn't have an apocalyptic ending. It has an ending in beauty, power, innocence, and in the finding of the right way to live on this planet. And we are now in that moment of Sophia's correction. So it's a tremendous place to be for everyone who comes into contact with this myth. It's a tremendous moment of opportunity.
Mm. Might I ask you one question when you refer to the correction? I know for myself and maybe others that are listening, having read your materials, you refer to the correction, Sophia correction, as a specific event, as in an initiate passing through the mysteries. This is something different that you're speaking about now, that's more of a cosmological event. Is that right?
That is exactly right, yes.
Okay. So you're making a distinction now between what you referred to several years ago as the Sophia correction on the individual level and then now the correction on the planetary wide level.
Exactly true. And the reason why I'm doing that is because correction is now underway. And I myself had the most astonishing experience since March of this year. When I restored the Gnostic myth and I ended it and I wrote it in a 9-episode framework, it's not the complete myth, there are more details, there are things to be elaborated, but there is a 9-episode framework that you work with. And this gives the plot structure of the myth and the sequence, which is very important. And when you read this story, it brings to mind, it brings before your imagination some really remarkable ideas about divinity. One of those ideas, and these ideas are different ways of looking at divinity than we are used to if you get your idea of divinity, say, from the Bible or Christianity, or even if you get it from some of the Asian religions. For instance, one of the things that you learn in this story is that the gods of the Pleroma, of the galactic center, which are called aeons, including Sophia, are not omniscient. Now, that's an interesting point.
That's not the usual prescription for divinity. It's omniscience is usually the first thing. Omnipotence and omniscience, right?
Yeah, that's almost a definition. If you ask someone, well, define God, you know, what is God or what is a God? One of the first things that they would say, oh, well, an all-present, all-knowing being, right?
Yep.
Someone who is omniscient. And I have to tell you that that concept of an omniscient God is just a construct. And as a matter of fact, it's a social construct that comes out of patriarchy and out of the paternal or male-dominated theocracies of the ancient Middle East. And the purpose of that concept, that has nothing to do with divinity, why God has been defined as omniscient, is so that those men who cite this omniscient God as their authority, and who may use the eye in the triangle as a symbol of that omniscience, are actually pulling off a huge con on the human race.
Yeah, they won't be questioned. They won't be questioned because they're being the mouthpiece of the omniscient one, right?
Exactly. And what is the first thing that omniscience does? It strikes fear in you. That's what it's supposed to do. Because you infer from that, oh, well, there's some big daddy. The English mystic William Blake called him Nobo Daddy. You know, Nobo Daddy. There's some big Nobo Daddy up there in the sky watching everything I do. And he's going to have my ass if I don't do what he wants. That is a completely paternalistic, theocratic construct of God, which is totally false.
Yeah.
Now, when you look at the mystery teachings, you get an entirely different picture. And the first picture you get is that accidents happen in the universe. The unexpected happens. Unexpected things happen to the goddess Sophia. Things she couldn't anticipate, nor was she able to foresee the end of the experiment in which she involved herself. And so this completely changes our relationship to the divine and makes it more empathetic, obviously. And although it doesn't bring the divine down to a human level, because we're still talking about superhuman powers, but it makes it possible for there to be a more egalitarian relationship, you could say, and interaction then comes into the picture. And, of course, the myth of Sophia is a myth of interactivity with the divine.
Okay.
Yeah, and that egalitarianism, it's inclusive. It's not exclusive like the chosen people kind of delusion that some religions suffer of.
Yes, that's right. In fact, the idea of the chosen people, as you know, which I've analyzed extensively and not in his image, is really one of the most toxic belief systems that was ever introduced on this planet. You know, there is no chosen people concept in the Sophia myth. The people of Sophia is the human species in its entirety, you see. And no race or no group has a privileged role in that respect.
And again, like you said, the first what is invoked of those who would worship the omniscient and omnipotent God is one of fear. That's the virtue of the olden days, was to be considered a God-fearing man. You know, it was a good thing if you were a God-fearing man, right?
That's right. That's right. This is the paradigm of the Abrahamic religions, the fear of God and the principle of obedience. Now, obedience has absolutely nothing to do with the mysteries, with initiation, with the discovery of our divine potential and our relationship to Sophia. It's not about obedience. It's about freedom. It's about novelty. And it's about having the courage to undergo immersed loss of your ego and to immerse yourself in the power of the earth and make that connection with her so that we can evolve together, you know, with the planet. This is a planetary myth. I want to emphasize that to people. It's not a vague and general abstract myth. It's specifically about our planet, the Earth, and how it came to be and how it appeared in the galaxy where it's located. And the conditions of that were unusual. Strange things happened. It's a very interesting story because when you follow the plot, as I say, it's very important to observe exactly how the plot works. because the directive power of the myth is in the plot. It's not just in one particular element of the story. It's not even just in the suggestion that the earth is a divine living being and you can meet her and connect with her. But it's in the whole trajectory of the story that the power of the story lies. And in this story, there is novelty, there is accidents, there is the unpredictable. For instance, give you an example, which is really beautiful, because it's such a teaching device. The myth says that the human species was engineered in the center of our galaxy. Now, you guys know that because you've read the story, and I can tell you really have understood it and taken it on board. So there you have. There's an answer. Where does the human race originate? Well, according to this myth, and myth meaning a story of power in a metaphorical or poetic form, not a fabrication, but a true story, according to this myth, our species, the genome of our species, was engineered in the center of the galaxy that we inhabit by these divine beings who may be thought of as divine scientists or engineers or artists. Yeah, I was talking about the episode, early episode in the Sophia myth that explains the origin of the human species. So according to these seers in the ancient mysteries, who were trained shamans and had a long, long tradition of practice behind them, they were rigorous investigators of the cosmos and of the human psyche. According to them, the notion that our species could have been created by some other extraterrestrial race from some planet or civilization elsewhere in the galaxy is totally wrong. It's not true. As a matter of fact, that story, which comes from the Anunnaki script of the Sumerian tablets, is in itself an ancient disinformation scam, which I've pointed out. And the problem with that story, and you would love this because this is the where it really breaks down. The problem with that story of the Anunnaki and the idea that ETs are responsible for the human species or either creating it or jump or meddling with our genes is that when you really look at it, it contains a slave species concept.
Yep.
And you have to then draw the line. You know, do you want to adopt a myth and allow your life to be impacted and perhaps even directed by a myth that says that humanity is a slave species? Or do you want to adopt a myth that says otherwise, you know? And yeah. So I really, refute that Anunnaki scenario entirely. And I point out that the Gnostics in their time also refuted it. And they said that, no, we're the creation of these aeons. Now, don't think of these aeons as angels. Don't think of them as anything anthropomorphic. If you have to visualize them at all, visualize them as great serpents. Not reptilians, but like great serpents. That is to say, great torrents of energy, like great torrents of plasmic energy, but of enormous beauty and power, circulating in the galactic center. They're alive. They're awake. They're conscious. They're super conscious. And they love to play and invent. So they invented a species called the Anthropos. That's us. We're one strain of it. And then they projected it out into the galactic arms. This is what they do. This is how it works. Because no animal species can evolve or appear in the galactic center, because it's the realm of the pure stellar and plasmic forces. So there have to be habitats. So the planetary worlds arise in the spiral arms of the galaxy. So they implanted it like a mycelium fiber in the constellation, in the nebula of Orion, in the constellation of Orion. And from that mycelium fiber, where the human genome is nested, filaments go out and seed in various worlds. And this is how the evolution, the emergence is a proper word, of the human species occurred. Now, coming back to the notion that I said that this myth is full of surprises and unexpected things, and they explain the human situation in an absolutely brilliant manner. Give you an example. When our species was engineered by Sophia and her consort called Thelete in the galactic center, we were projected, we were not designed to deal with the Archons, because the Archons didn't exist at that time. The Archons only came about when Sophia departed from the Galactic Center and she herself fell into the realm of dense materiality of the Galactic Arms. And as a result of that, it was kind of an accident. She created this fracture zone, as it were, in the realm of elementary matter. And in this fracture zone, these Archon entities sprang up. She didn't expect that to happen. It was an unanticipated event. And then when she morphed into the planet Earth and we began to emerge on this planet, our species was seeded here and we began to emerge and evolve, we found ourselves in a cosmos with these Archons lurking around, not on the Earth itself, but lurking around in the solar system. Well, that was a completely unprecedented event. That wasn't anticipated when our species was originally designed. Now, let's just stop for a minute and ask ourselves, what does that story, that's rather a complex plot, but once you get your mind around it, think about it for a minute and ask, well, what does that myth tell us about the human situation today? Well, it tells us why evil, or so-called human evil, manipulation, control, secrecy, and deception seem to have the advantage in this world.
Yeah.
Because we as a species are really not, in fact, equipped to deal with the levels of deception that are occurring in our world. And that is explain something that has haunted me and troubled me all my life. You know, why does deception work so well? And why does it allow the wrong people, that is to say sick human beings, psychopaths, and control freaks, allow them to get the advantage on the great mass of people? Why are we so gullible? We are gullible as a species. And the myth explains that that is our disadvantage. And so we are at a disadvantage when it comes to dealing with this archonic factor of secrecy and deception. And certainly it can get out of control as it is today. I mean, there is so much secrecy about everything going on in the world today. Finances, the military, the UFO phenomenon, the way the media is run, the way our society is run. There's so much secrecy and deception that it's really overwhelming. And so the myth explains very clearly how we got into this mess that we're in today, but it also explains and gives us a solution. And that's just one example of how brilliant it is as a tool for really discerning and mastering the human condition.
Okay, John, let me see if I can understand this. Okay, so...
Sure.
You're saying, and I'm pretty clear on this, the Archons are like the unintended consequence, like an overspray, if you were painting a wall, and the overspray became animated almost. That's the Archons.
Exactly.
And so, like in nature, most systems in nature are run in tandem. There's always a problem maybe that could arise, but there would be a solution. For example, right. We have in our habitat, we have thousands of plant species that we could use for healing ourselves.
Right.
So there's nature's provision of a need to be a solution or a cure to an aberrance or an affliction. And because the Archons are not, in fact, an intention within our reality, there is no tandem solution that already ready made. One has to be formed, is what you're saying. Is
that's
that right?
Right.
Or is that safe to say?
That is brilliantly put. That's a great paraphrase of what the myth teaches. They are the challenge. You see, they're not part of the symbiotic web of life. When you look at the symbiotic web of life on the Earth and even extending out beyond the Earth, there is always a check and balance in everything
yes.
that happens, you know?
Yes.
All different species are related to each other, as you say, in tandem processes. The tantric principle of duality and compensation is everywhere. But the Archons are actually an unanticipated parasitic entity that intrudes upon this experiment with humanity that Sophia herself had dreamed up and wanted to see played out. And so we have to take special measures to deal with it. We are provided by those measures. And the key to making things right on this planet is to correcting the deviance that comes from this archontic factor. That is a huge, huge challenge. So to bring it down to the present, we want now to have, we want to see a breakthrough now. And many of us feel that we're very near this breakthrough. And I would say that the sign that we are indeed at a breakthrough for humanity, looking toward a way to get to a better world of love, freedom, and mutual aid, is the overthrow of secrecy. The overthrow of secrecy. There can be no secrecy in an open and free society. John Kennedy said that, didn't he, a couple of months before they shot him.
Wow. Okay. Jack?
Yeah, we agree, because, you know, a lot of the manipulators that go on, that are out there, they fear exposure. They fear the knowledge of what they do, and I agree with that sentiment about secrecy, John.
Yeah, the fear-mongers and the ones who want us to be afraid and to a certain extent attempt to control society through fear and through the insinuation of mind-programming devices, mind-programming schemes, themselves live in tremendous fear. You know, they stink of fear, you know?
Yep.
And the fact is very simple. When you look at the world today and you're sickened by the orchestrations of evil, for instance, the financial scams that are going down. You know, the Fed was a criminal scam. I mean, the international banking system is a criminal mafia. When you look at that, it's disgusting, and one can feel very overwhelmed and overpowered. But the fact is, they can't do any of that except through secrecy. And so the real battle is the battle in overcoming secrecy. Yeah, I just want to say it's a huge pleasure and a thrill to discuss this myth with you in this way, because every time I go over the myth myself, I realize in a new way how powerful and relevant it is. And sharing it with you is even now bringing that to the forefront of my mind. I can clarify something about this myth as we continue on this vein, that again distinguishes it from the typical, say, Judeo-Christian story about God. In the Judeo-Christian mythology, or almost any other mythology that you can name, the omniscient Father God lays down a set of rules. And these rules come through the Messiah or through some prophet who is always a man. It's a whole male-dominated process. And the gist of this whole program is simple. The omniscient Father God, you know, tells you what to do. So, you have the Ten Commandments. That's God telling you what to do. Or you have the teachings of Jesus. That's the Messiah telling you what to do. So, step back for a minute and look at what this is. It's a mythology in which certain men who bring this mythology to humanity, be they St. Paul or Muhammad or Abraham, claim that they know what God is telling you to do, right?
Yes.
Now that is a disaster formula, because it's just a pretext for men to take control of society and pretend that they are God. And it's delusional and harmful. Now compare that to the Sophia myth. We're talking about the Sophia myth now. We're going to bring it right up current to Sophia's correction and the consummation of the work of the Archons, which is right now. What's different about the Sophia myth? There is no God-given commandments in this myth that purport to tell you what to do. The story tells you what to do. That's the fantastic thing about it. The story is the cure. The story is the guide. The story tells you what to do. And for instance, when we understand that our species was engineered with certain amazing properties, the ability for language and symbol making to an extraordinary degree, the ability to extrapolate, to plan, to model, the capacity to have dialogue, to compare things that allows us to argue and to solve problems together, problem-solving abilities in our species are absolutely extraordinary. Metanoia, the ability to form paradigms and then actually grow out of the paradigm that we formed and grow to the next paradigm, so that we're not ever stuck in a framework of our own mental contrivance. All these fantastic abilities, the ability to play, to experiment, are engineered into our species. But the ability to face the levels of deception that we have been brought to by this false paternalistic religion and the archonic deception working through it, we're not equipped for that. You see?
Yes.
And so the story then says, well, what are we going to do when we're in face of something that we're not equipped to deal with? And the story, the story also gives us that answer.
And that answer is?
Twofold, my friends. The first thing is, become fucking ruthless.
Yes.
That's the first thing.
Imperative.
We are not ruthless. We are not ruthless. That's the problem with our species. And I mean for good people to be ruthless. I'm not talking about the ruthlessness of these sicko, control freak, serial killer type psychopaths. We need to be as ruthless as they are and more, but be ruthless out of goodness and out of the love for truth and freedom. Just imagine that. That's the challenge. You know, this myth challenges us to the absolute best that is in our species, in human nature. And one of the challenges is to become warriors of Gaia, to protect life, to protect the planet, and to protect the human species from its greatest threat. And its greatest threat is not the Archons. Its greatest threat is intra-species predators who are run by the Archons.
Mm. Predators within our own species, you're saying.
Predators within our own species. That's right. And so the first challenge, the myth tells us, the story tells us what to do. There's no divine authority talking through the story, because it is a true story about a divine being whose life is intimately connected with ours. The story tells us what to do. So there are two things. First, it says, become ruthless, become warriors in the cause of love and truth and freedom. And the second thing it says is, use the special power that was given to us by Sophia to deal with the Archons and to repel the Archontic influence. Now, the myth explains this in a very interesting detail. It says that before the Earth was created and the human species appeared on the Earth, we had already been created, and we were existing in the larval or embryonic form that we exist in the mycelium web, where our species genome is nested. But we had not appeared yet on the planet Earth. In fact, the Earth itself didn't yet exist. And Sophia, in the early stages of the solar system, before the Earth was, she morphed into the Earth, is facing the Archons. And suddenly she realizes, uh-oh, these Archons are parasites. They don't observe their boundaries. They love deception and simulation. They're going to intrude upon the experiment with humanity when humanity emerges. So I've got to do something about this. And so she took a special measure, and she gave us an additional gift that was not coded into our genome in the galactic center. And that additional gift is called the luminous epinoia in the Gnostic cosmology. And what it means is the power of imagination. So what we have to do is we have to claim back and own the true power of imagination. And this is a very big challenge, because there is a problem with imagination in our species. And that problem is due to the nature of the human ego, that there's a great tendency in the human species to take the power of imagination that exists in each person and to elaborate it into fabrications which are of a narcissistic and self-referencing nature. That is to say, we jerk off and masturbate with fantasy and imagination.
Yeah, I could see that.
And doing that, we can go off into all kinds of tangents. So, the challenge of the imagination was pointed out very clearly by the medieval alchemists, who were in certain respects a continuation of the mystery schools, the true and genuine alchemists who realized the presence of the organic light and who understood intimately our relation to nature. They had a beautiful formula that they left us. They said, in all of your operations, learn from nature, follow the wisdom of and the teachings that nature herself presents, and do so with the true and not the fantastic imagination. So they made this very clear distinction between true imagination and fantastic imagination. And we, if we're going to claim back the power of imagination now and claim back our world and pursue this divine experiment, which is why we're here, we have to make this distinction. And I've pondered this a lot lately, and I've been discussing it with quite a few people. And I've come up with what I think is a helpful definition of the true imagination to distinguish it from the fantastic or delusional imagination. And I'd like to offer that to you, if I may.
Please.
May.
It's very simple. The true imagination is the imagination that incorporates her story. And the false imagination is everything that doesn't.
Okay.
Simple as that.
So, John, let me ask you a question. Because the first thing that comes to mind for me as an individual when I hear you say that there's these distinctions that we have to make between the true and the false, and you did make that distinction right there as it must incorporate her story. But isn't it possible that as we are prone to error, that one might incorporate her story into an egotistical or egocentric a fantasy imagination and therefore serve that same ego we wish to avoid? And how would one, other than maybe the cultivation of a powerful self-awareness, make that? How can we trust, is I guess what I'm getting to, ourselves if we're prone to error?
It's a beautiful observation, and we are prone. It would be more, not so much the error, the threat of error, but the error of our egotism. You know, how do we know that our egotism is not going to take over this story and turn it into just another power trip or another narcissistic fantasy? How do we know? Well, I can tell you how the Gnostics dealt with that, how the Telestai dealt with that, and I can suggest how we in our time might do the same. Their way of dealing with it was brilliant. They used psychoactive plants, and the purpose of the practice that they had, they were shamans, the purpose of their practices with psychoactive plants was very simple, because when you take certain plants, such as the psilocybe mushrooms and other plants that have these psychoactive properties, it momentarily reduces the ego. Filters of the ego dissolve, and you become immersed in a selfless and egoless manner in the raw power and beauty of the natural world. And by making that connection, you build up something in your psyche that works against your ego and prevents you from falling into the error and the indulgence of egotism. So, as I said in Not in His Image, the primary purpose of initiation in the mysteries was ego death. And I encourage everyone to undergo ego death on every occasion that they can. Because, first of all, it's harmless, you know, and it's only your ego that dies. It's not you. And it's wonderful to survive without your ego. Now, the ego is kind of like a yo-yo, you know, so it will bounce back. But every time that you are able to put your ego aside and selflessly immerse yourself, that is the word, immersion, transcendence, as you quoted the word that I made up. Transcendence means to transcend the sense of single self-identity, single self-entity. Transcend that and transcendence and merge into the realm of the senses. This was the practice in the ancient mysteries, and this is the practice that we can do today, using these psychoactive plants in a rigorous and disciplined manner.
Okay,
we can do it.
Could I interrupt?
Yeah.
You say rigorous and disciplined manner. Just to make a distinction, let me ask a couple things. First of all, could a person undergo an ego death as a pinnacle isolated event, and that be enough to sustain the effects of such an ego death? Could be enough to sustain an individual who would then partake of the true imagination? Or is it? Are you saying it's something that a person should continue to pursue as a regular practice?
You know, it varies with every person. And I would put it this way. In some cases, it might be possible for an individual, say you could do it with LSD, really, really good LSD, to have the ego death experience and to reach such a high mark that it would then leave, that it sort of takes you to that high mark, and that high mark of egolessness remains in your psyche for the rest of your life as a point of reference. You see what I mean? And
yes.
Then from that point of reference, you could handle your own egotism very, very skillfully. Some people might be able to do it that way. Some people might need to do it more progressively, you know, systematically in a number of experiences, you know. It depends. The Gnostics themselves, the Telestai, the teachers of the mystery schools, were absolute masters in helping people determine these things. They vetted people very carefully. They really allowed people to show them what their individual potential was so that they could guide each person to this egoless state. So there's a different formula for everyone. But to give you the short answer, yeah, it would be possible to have a real peak or pinnacle experience that would then temper your ego for the rest of your life. Once you've seen through yourself, you tend to remember what it looks like, you know?
Yeah, you can make it as a reference point. And I'm sort of speaking from experience here. I had some experiences many years ago with Amanito, and
sure.
It was one of those, you know, I had a vision. I saw the future, really. You know, I didn't know it at the time, but I found out later that I was watching the future, you know. And it was something that I probably wouldn't partake of today, you know what I mean? But it has sustained me. It has given me insight, I think, into myself and into what you're speaking of, the egolessness, which I think is, I used to call it ego deflation. It was the means of, because I felt like I had been raised in an American culture, I had an inflated ego, I used to say.
That's right.
You know,
right.
It was so ego, so filled with ego, it was like everything related to me, you know, and it was all about me, you know, and it was the real growth in myself came when I deflated that ego, you know.
Well, Frater X, it's that skillful device we were talking about last week.
Sure, that's a good point, Jack. We mentioned the term upaya, the Sanskrit term, and how we were making the reference to those who would want to hold on to that boat that they used to cross the river, even though it would be impractical because it had been an effective vehicle at the time. But one must like put down the upaya and look for another, maybe at the, you know, the next obstacle.
That's right. Upaya, skillful means. We only use the tool to get us to a place, then we don't attach to the tool. But you see, the key to that again is the ego, because the ego is the source of all attachment. Yeah, I'd just like to bring it up to the present, and then I'd be happy to speak to anyone who's waiting on the phone lines. I define gnosis as full-body cognitive ecstasy. It's a trance state. It's an ecstatic trance. And what you know and learn and see in gnosis is things that can only be seen in a state of ecstasy. So we can know, we are knowing species, we can learn and know many things in many ways, but this way of knowing through ecstasy is the way of gnosis, full body cognitive ecstasy. And the Telestai of the Mysteries were experts at it, and they reached those states of cognitive ecstasy through the skillful and disciplined and rigorous use of psychoactive plants, but not just that. They also reached them through dance and through acoustic practices of chanting. Now, today, we can make a connection with the goddess and the connection with Sophia in our own way. And that is what planetary tantra is. We, in a sense, have advantages today. And we have a path opening now, open now, that even the initiates of the mysteries didn't have. What is so unique about the opportunity today is that the divine Sophia, who is embodied in the earth, is now turning her attention to humanity and connecting with us consciously. And that is what planetary tantra is. It's the practice of interactivity with the entire consciousness of the planet. Now, I want you to try to take that idea on board. Let me give you an analogy that may help. We know that each of us is a full-grown human being with fingers, arms, and legs, a face, a brain, and that the human body consists of billions and billions of cells. And as the current situation stands with human beings, we are not divine. And since we are not divine beings, we cannot actually communicate with every single one of our cells, nor can every single one of our cells communicate with us. But that is the nature of a divine being. And so the divine Sophia, the goddess who's embodied in the earth, can actually communicate with each human being as you would communicate with a single cell in your body. And I have to tell you that when you have the entire planet on the other end of your attention, that is a fantastic experience. It's an overwhelming experience, but it's an experience that you learn to stand in and hold that power. It's a power-sharing arrangement. So what we can do today that is the equivalent of what the Gnostics did is, first of all, make a pact with Gaia. You do this by doing the Gaian Tantric Vow, which is a very simple thing. You make it up yourself. The formula for the vow is given, the framework is given on medhistory.org. You make a vow to the goddess, to the living Sophia, who is the earth, of your commitment to her and of what you would like to offer her and do with her and do for her, just as you would make a pact with anyone else, someone you marry, a business partner, someone who is your counterpart in a creative venture. Make that pact with her and call her name. She has this name that she will answer to. And the reason why this name is so powerful is that it gets her attention. And I've had people write me now over the last year or so since I put the Gaian Tantric Vow on the site and I laid all this out in Planetary Tantra. People who do the vow, you don't have to believe anything. It's a very simple process. People who do the vow go out into nature and they call her name. I've reported the most remarkable things. And what you get is a response when you call her name. This can happen. And it's a momentous thing to experience. When it happens to you, you know that it's totally real. And so once you have her attention, and once you've made this vow, then the interactivity begins. And this interactivity is what is now the great opportunity for our species to bring us out of this nightmare that we have fallen into due to the dual factor, the pathology of interspecies predators, exaggerated by the secrecy and deception of the archons. Is that clear?
Very clear. That is excellent. Excellent commentary, John. Well, did you want to take a moment and just see what this caller has to say that we've got on our call banks? They've been waiting for a while. We'd like to honor them by giving them a chance to ask you a question.
Certainly.
Okay, great. Let me just bring them up here. And
thank you for waiting so long, caller. We really appreciate you.
Okay, the caller at the 919 area code, you are live with author John Lamlash here at Radio Free Humanity.
Hello, Frater. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm very well. This is Soren 7000. And Mr. Lamlash, hello. How are you?
I'm very fine.
Great. As I was listening to your discussion of the difference between the Judeo-Christian belief and Gaia, and I'm actually on planetarytantra.com now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a kind of a blurring line between ethos, and I would just like to get your opinion on the genesis of your belief.
Mm-hmm. The genesis of my beliefs.
Yes,
well, my beliefs are all based on the Gnostic practice, which was a traditional shamanic practice, and on our planet for many thousands of years. I'm kind of a revivalist of that tradition. As I said, Gnosis is full body cognitive ecstasy. So everything that I talk about in metahistory.org and everything I talk about in Planetary Tantra comes directly from the knowledge of my own body. My body is the instrument that I use to access the Gaian awareness and to learn from the earth and to contact the actual living presence of the earth as if it were an entity, as if it were another person. Everyone can do this. It's a practice, and that's what I do. So that's the genesis of my beliefs, if you want to call them beliefs. It's the genesis of my practice and the way that I verify what I do. I don't do anything out of the body. I don't go to other dimensions. I don't dream up make-believe stories and fabrications. I stay very close to the sacred narrative of the myth, because that is the guiding myth for our species. It is our story. And within that framework of that story, I do these simple practices and take nature as the absolute touchstone of truth. I observe nature as the absolute touchstone of truth.
So, John, would you say that cultivating a powerful and dynamic self-awareness is key to the practice for each individual?
I would say that the word self-awareness is a little deceptive and can very easily go archontic. What I like to say about Planetary Tantra, I like to use the word power, because I like power. But when I say that, let me qualify. I don't mean I like to have power over other people. I mean that I like the feeling of power. For instance, look at something like someone conducting an orchestra, or someone playing in the orchestra. Or look at something like a tennis match and two tennis players whacking away, or two figure skaters. That's a beautiful thing to see. In all those examples, those human beings are in acts of great power. They're in the power of a dance. It's like the power of a dance. And this is the kind of power that you have when you connect with the Mother Source. And to play with that power, and to enjoy handling it, and to learn how to use it, and to perform acts of beauty and wisdom and generosity and play with that power, this is the practice of Planetary Tantra. And it's not about developing a God consciousness or self-awareness as such. That tends very easily to deviate into narcissism. Whereas power is always relational, you know? Tantra is about the dynamics of relation, the self and the other. It's not some trip of going into God consciousness and into the higher self. That is not Tantra, and that is not Gnosis.
That was my actual point, to disseminate the power between the self-God consciousness, or, you know, as us being, as human beings, being our own God, as opposed to what you have just described, which is a relatively beautiful thing, and which I am a self-subscriber to. So I just wanted to disseminate your beliefs on that system.
Well, thank you for that question. And I take great pains, as the friends who are doing the show here will tell you, because they've read Not in His Image meticulously. I take great pains to show that the Gnostics did not teach that we are gods. That is a false Luciferic teaching. They taught that we have a God-like faculty, and that the secret of realizing human potential is to develop this God-like faculty called nous, which is actually implanted in us by the pleromic aeons. But we are not gods. It's not a God trip or a divine ego trip. This is not what you find. In fact, you find liberation from the ego and even liberation from the self along the path that Gnosis opened for us. I like to make that distinction. Yeah.
That term nous that you said was N-O-U-S, correct?
Yeah, nous. That's right.
Yes.
Okay. Great. I had one more question.
Sure.
Totally diverted from this subject. I had been doing some recent research on Nicholas Roerich,
mm-hmm.
and the Stone of Destiny. Can I get any commentary on that, possibly?
I know that Rorik was an extraordinary man, and he was a genuine mystic. He had real mystical experiences. His wife founded the Agni Yoga Society. I think there's a certain cultic aspect to what they were doing. It's been so long since I've looked into his work, but he had a fantastic life, and he was an artist and a mystic and a traveler. And worth investigating the man just for the story of his life. Yeah.
Any commentary on the Master Building in New York and the correlation between Rorik and Manly Hall and the
against that whole crowd? I'm totally against masters. I'm totally against the hierarchy concept. I think it's a huge con. It goes back. It's just an aberration that goes back to theocracy. Theocracy is really, really bad news. And the Himalayan Brotherhood, the Manly Palmer Hall's idea of the elite guiding brotherhood, call them the Rosicrucians, call them whatever you want.
Yeah.
It's all the same scam. And I don't buy that scam at all. That scam is not favorable to children and animals, nor is it favorable to the divine experiment as Sophia sees it.
What a great way to put it.
Very good to hear you say that, Matt Lash. I appreciate the commentary. I really do.
Appreciate talking to you. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Thank
so
you,
much.
Soren 7000. We love hearing from you. Please call
All right,
in again.
Better.
Okay.
Right.
And so, John, so how would the ancient Fosters or Teleste, how would they go about guiding the individual initiate if not through some sort of hierarchical master-initiate dynamic?
Yeah. There was no hierarchical master-initiate dynamic. There was a teamwork, an egalitarian teamwork, consisting of very balanced teams, cells of 8 and 16 people, equally balanced between 4 male members and 4 female members. When they would meet, when these Gnostic cells would meet, they would choose lots. So suppose they were going to spend a weekend together and do some shamanic exercises and investigate certain questions together. They worked in teams. They would need a leader for the team simply because any kind of group activity does need someone to sort of set the format and set the agenda. They would choose lots.
So each time there would be a new leader.
That's right. That's right. And when you think of the mysteries, the one thing that you really want to bear in mind is that they were not only a systematic, initiatory framework for exploring altered states, for developing the noetic sciences, parapsychological investigations, deep investigations of the supernatural and the Nahual, but they were educational systems. So to the extent that there was any hierarchy at all, it was the hierarchy that you would find of a natural sort in a classroom. But that hierarchy is completely flexible because as students advance, there's no more, no one is restricted to any particular level. There's no secrecy. There was no secrecy about the mysteries. This is a really big mistake. They were not operating on a secret agenda.
Yes, caller at the 740 area code. What do you have for us?
Greetings. This is Terry from Virginia, actually.
Hi, Terry.
And hello. Hello. And I'm sitting on my porch now, engaged in what I am able in my heart of planetary tantra. But unfortunately, I have a cloudy sky, so I thought to ask a question that has been somewhat disturbing me for the 3 months I've been on this particular path. And as I embrace the mythos and have lived into the story, I'm having a little bit of confusion of distinguishing between Thelete and the Christos energies. Now, I'm associating the Christos somehow with the solar energies. Am I right in that thinking? And how may I make the distinguish between those two characters?
Sure. This is important because there was actually a variation of the Gnostic mythology. This is called the Valentinian spin-off. And in the Valentinian school, which came out of Alexandria, at the time of Christianity, a group of Gnostics, Telestai, led by Valentinus, tried to make a sort of a compromise with the upcoming Christian religion. So they took a part of the mystery teaching concerning the Christos, and they kind of tried to graft it on to this Christian ideology. And this created some really difficult problems, which kind of linger to this day. So I'd like to clarify it for you as briefly as I can. In the Galactic Center, where the human genome was designed in the genius of these God beings, we envision a dual set of aeons, which would be Sophia and Thelete, T-H-E-L-E-T-E, meaning the intended. So they would be, as it were, according to the strict plot of the story, our parents, not our biological parents, but the creative divine artists who conceived our species. The Christos is also an aeon or god in the company of the Pleroma. But the Christos ought to be understood not as a parenting entity and not as associated with the sun either. I don't know where this thing about the Christos associated with the sun comes from. It's certainly not in the Telestic teachings and not in any of the Gnostic material I've restored, you know? What you want to think of, you want to read the Christic intercession in Not in His Image, and read Mesotes, M-E-S-O-T-E-S, the Mesotes, or the intermediary. The Christos was an intermediary. It was one of the pleromic aeons who came to the earth after the earth had formed, when the divine Sophia was in fact overwhelmed by the status of being morphed into a planet. And suddenly she had enormous abundance of life forms around her that were welling up everywhere in her body, because her body is a body of pure living light. And when it morphed into the physical elements of the earth, it produced all these forms. And so the pleromic gods, so the myth tells us, saw that she was overwhelmed and could not handle them, and that the Christos intervened. So he's called the Mesotes, or the intermediary. And the Christos is actually the pleromic aeon who does not reside on earth, but visited the earth, as it were, to assist Sophia at a critical moment. And the after effect of the Christos residing in the earth is a kind of a luminous imprint, which many people have seen. It is called the etheric Christ. It has very different names, but it has nothing to do with the savior of Christianity, and it has absolutely nothing to do with a divine Messiah figure who sacrifices itself for humanity. That is not the Christos aeon in the strict Gnostic teaching. The Christos aeon left us a richer and tighter symbiotic fiber. He helped Sophia to organize the symbiotic organization of all species. And so the Christos represents that factor in the life of our planet, and does not represent a messianic intervention of any kind. So those two entities are quite distinct, and I hope that description helps.
Yes, yes. I certainly had recognized that they were distinct. I just couldn't, I too, for some reason, have associated it with the solar energy, probably from other, myths that I've heard and pondered upon in the past and attached to it, but it didn't make sense to me either from within the story.
It doesn't make sense, Terry. And I want to warn you as well that there are people today who are picking up fragments and snippets of the Sophia myth and weaving it into their own programs. And in doing so, for instance, they might associate Christos with the sun, or they might adopt the Valentinian view, which I don't support, that Christos was the aeon who was parenting to our species. But those people who are doing that are not observing the story. The power and beauty of this story is that you observe the entire story faithfully. It doesn't mean that it's rigid and it can't be expanded and elaborated, because it can. For instance, one of the things that we're now going to elaborate and discover for ourselves is what actually is the relation between Gaia Sophia and the sun. We don't know anything about the sun. We don't even know what the sun is. And there's been a lot of fear-mongering about the sun, you know. coronal mass emissions are going to fry us like French fries and wipe out the human race and so forth and so on. Well, the Gnostic myth indicates that there's a benevolent, lasting and benevolent pact between the earth and the sun. And it's now the moment for us to discover whether that is true or not. So we've got a lot to learn here about the cosmos, and the myth is a beautiful way, a beautiful framework for that learning process.
So, John, you had originally presented, am I mistaken? When you originally presented the story of the goddess, wasn't Christos the consort that you had originally presented in the story?
Right. That's right. It's a very good observation, and I want to have the opportunity to correct this here. What I did as I was presenting the story and not in his image is that I presented the Valentinian idea as a possible option. That was an option because I want to show that the Gnostics did have some differences of opinion on things, but it was not an option that really worked out well. So strictly and rigorously, I make Thelete and Sophia to be the pair who engineered the human genome, and I include the Aeon Christos, but not in that role. So that is how I would propose to develop the story at this time.
And the Thelete, that's the Greek for will, right? Theleme?
Yeah. Will, or the intended.
And it's so from it's the Thelete. Wisdom.
Yeah.
Wisdom and intention.
Are our parents. Our parents are wisdom and the intended. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, Jack, did you have something?
Yeah, we have just like 2 minutes left, so I just wanted to especially just take some time here at the end to say a special thanks to our callers, thanks to Soren 7000, thanks to Terry from Virginia for calling in, especially thank you for calling in representing the feminine principle so that there's not just three men here talking.
Absolutely.
And thanks to everyone.
I was so glad you called, really. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, we really appreciate your calls. And thanks to everyone who tuned in. Thanks to our great friends in the chat room. Thanks to everyone at American Freedom Radio. And a big thanks to John Lash for joining us today. Mr. Lash?
Yes, my pleasure. And just remember that you're not just a biological creature of this planet, but you're also a character in the dream of the divine Sophia.
Awesome sentiment.
Okay. And we have just a couple minutes left, just a minute and a half or so, if you want to take us out, John.
Well, actually, go ahead, John.
Yeah, that planetary tantra is actually a rapturous immersion in her dreaming power. She's dreaming, and the dream is an experiment with humanity, and we are at the verge of discovering that divine experiment. And big part of that experiment is free energy. You know, I love the concept of American Free Humanity Radio, but we have to remember that humanity is never going to be free on this planet to create a cooperative society until we have free energy. We have it, but it's being kept secret. And when that secret is removed, we will indeed be living in the world that Sophia dreams for us.
That's a very pertinent point you make, John. And we also address the concept of renewable energy and free energy for all. We've looked at that issue ourselves, and we understand its importance.
Yes, this is a cause that all human beings can equally embrace because it will put our society on a fair basis.
Okay, well, thank you so much, author John Lamb Lash, metahistory.org. Everyone check out that website, and stay tuned next week for either rebroadcast of this or Jack Marshak's solo project on Radio Free Humanity. Good night, everyone.